And so today we're going to turn our attention to this issue of justification by faith alone. It's recorded that, you know, of justification, it's been said by Luther that this one and firm rock, which we call the doctrine of justification, is the chief article of the whole Christian doctrine, which comprehends the understanding of all godliness. So this is an important deal, and this is part of our shared collective story as we tell our story as a Reformed Church and reflect on our history and how we've gotten to this particular place in time. Then the story of how Martin Luther arrived at the doctrine of justification by faith alone, it plays a big role in how we understand ourselves and just all Protestants, you know, how we understand our history. So what we're going to do this morning is we have quite a bit of ground to cover. And so what I'd like to do is I want to talk about how this doctrine developed in Luther's thinking. But I want to talk about it and kind of frame the conversation by the way that he described the way that he came to this. There's a preface to the first published, like the first time his collected works were published in Latin in 1545. Martin Luther, he wrote a little preface for it. And in that preface, he gives a little bit of the background and a little bit of the history of how he arrived at his conclusions. And so it's in this little autobiographical fragment that he tells the story of what led to the discovery or the rediscovery of justification by faith alone. So we're going to read through a little bit of what he has to say on it, and then we'll stop, we'll take breaks, we'll try to expand and explain what he's talking about, and then trace it back. So hopefully also this morning we'll have time for a lot of questions, because I'm kind of counting on that to fill out some of the time. All right, here we go. So he says this about midway through this preface. He says this. He says, in that same year, so 1519, I had begun interpreting the Psalms once again, and I felt confident that I was now more experienced, since I had dealt in university course with St. Paul's letters to the Romans, to the Galatians, and the letter to the Hebrews. So I'm just going to pause there real quick. So this is him reflecting back on his academic career. And in 1519, he says that for the second time, he's about to lecture through the book of Psalms. And notice that, you know, he says that at this point, he's already lectured through several books, right? He's lectured through Romans. So he's already gone through, interpreted, and taught on the book of Romans. He's done the same thing for the book of Galatians and Hebrews. And now he's arriving back at the book of Psalms for the second time. And, you know, it's not to be taken lightly that he has been studying the Bible throughout his whole academic career, giving it serious attention and serious study. And yet, he still can't say with all confidence that he knows exactly what they mean, or what they mean particularly in light of the topic of justification. You know, he's just an example that, you know, for a long time, you know, for centuries on end, the Christian church has been reading and interpreting the Bible. And they've been reading the Bible under a very powerful set of assumptions that weren't easily overcome, that would lead Luther, upon reflection, to say that even at that point, he really didn't understand this notion of justification. And so he continues in this little autobiographical reflection. He says, I had conceived a burning desire to understand what Paul meant in his letter to the Romans, but thus far there had stood in my way not the cold blood around my heart, but that one word which in chapter 1 says, the justice of God is revealed in it. So he says, again, just saying he's excited about interpreting the Psalms again because he's still struggling over understanding what Paul has to say regarding the justice of God and how the justice of God is revealed in the gospel. He continues, I hated that word, justice of God, which, by the use and custom of all my teachers, I had been taught to understand philosophically as referring to formal or active justice, as they call it, that justice by which God is just and by which he punishes sinners and the unjust. But I, blameless monk that I was, felt that before God I was a sinner with an extremely troubled conscience. I couldn't be sure that God was appeased by my satisfaction. I did not love, no, rather I hated the just God who punishes sinners. In silence, if I did not blaspheme, then certainly I grumbled vehemently and got angry at God. I said, isn't it enough that we miserable sinners, lost for all eternity because of original sin, are oppressed by every kind of calamity through the Ten Commandments? Why does God heap sorrow upon sorrow through the gospel, and through the gospel threaten us with his justice and his wrath? This was how I was raging with wild and disturbed conscience. I constantly badgered St. Paul about that spot in Romans 1 and anxiously wanted to know what he meant. Okay, so this is his reflection on Romans 1. So one of the things he mentions there that we want to spend some time on is, you know, he's describing himself, obviously agonizing over how this good news could be so burdening, could be so overwhelming and terrible. For him, at this, you know, reflecting back and at this time, the gospel resulted in this extremely troubled conscience, the exact opposite of what you would expect to find in the gospel, which is rest and assurance of God's good favor. So I want us to try, if you can, to imagine what he's going through and try to understand what he's talking about. And we'll break down some of the things he says here. But the first thing I want you to do is take your Bible and turn to Romans 1, what he's talking about. Turn to Romans 1. And we'll look exactly at that part that was troubling him so much. Romans 1, 16 and 17. The Apostle Paul says this. He says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it," that is the gospel, "the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." So there's a couple things here that are troubling him, that are shaking him to his core. And really, it's going to be difficult for us to identify with him, to understand where he's coming from. But the two things that are shaking him is that in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed first, and it's available and accessible for those through faith or by faith. Now, why are those sound good to us? Like, you know, there's a righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. Like, that sounds great. Why is this scary to him? Well, if we go back and reread one part of his preface, remember he says that he had been taught to understand a couple of things. That the righteousness of God philosophically referred to this idea of an active justice or an active righteousness. And it's that justice by which God is just and by which he punishes sinners and the unjust. So he has this problem with this notion of the justice of God, because at that point, he conceived of this passage and of the righteousness of God as an active justice or a formal justice. If you think back to, we've talked about it for the last 2 weeks, and we're going to likely refer to this over and over again. If you look at the medieval, or what we know now as the Roman Catholic soteriology, we have to understand that when they talk about certain things and certain terms, they understand them in a fundamentally different way than we do. I mean, last week, Kenny asked us the question, a very interesting question, and he asked us, how are we to understand Roman Catholics when we talk to them, and we disagree so much about common terms? See, if you ask a Roman Catholic, are you saved by grace? They would say, sure. If you ask a Roman Catholic, is it necessary for you to have faith? You saved by faith. They would say, yeah, absolutely. And then if you ask them, do you require a righteousness to be saved? Again, they would say, yes, you absolutely do need a, a righteousness. But of course, the devil is in the details. And all of these things, all of these words, these concepts mean different things. And so what he has to overcome in order to get to justification by faith is, first of all, this notion of an active righteousness. If you recall, in the Roman Catholic or medieval system, we talked about righteousness, about the righteousness that is required to save you has to be it has to be inherent. Hopefully I spelled that right. And intrinsic. What do I mean by those? That you need to have a righteousness that is inherent, that is intrinsic. What are we referring to when we mention those words? Yes, Greg. Yeah, exactly. You have to be truly righteous in your person. Remember, we drew that little picture of the guy, and we had to fill him up had to fill up your tank of righteousness according to merit, and we said that in order to be saved, you have to be truly and properly righteous, and this is because the assumptions at the time is that you could only call something and consider something righteous if it really was righteous, and this is it's a little hard to explain. But the whole way of understanding the world at that time required you to consider things like to have this intrinsic, inherent property. So like to call something righteous, like a person, means that it has to be righteous in and of itself. Abstracting righteousness away from the individual, from the person, from their body, from their existence, that was a very foreign idea. So, let me just give you an example. So yesterday in the morning, it was the girls were running around the house, and the littlest one, Monica, who's 2 years old, she has a little wallet, so she ran up to me, and she asked for some money, and she wanted a lot of money for her wallet, okay? And so I pulled out my wallet, and all I had were a couple of $5 bills. Now, $5 to give to a 2-year-old for no good reason, that's a hefty investment, right? But that's all I had on me. So I took out my $5 bill, and I handed it to her, and she just stared at me with a very confused and almost like disappointed face. She goes, "What is? No, I want money." And I'm like, "It's $5." She's like, "No, I don't want dollars. I want money." It's like, "Oh." So we go to the piggy bank. I dump out a bunch of like pennies and nickels and give her a handful, and she's like, "Oh, I got so much money now, right? I have all this money for my purse." Because for her, at her young age, she can't conceive of things in this sort of abstract way. She can't assign value to just a little piece of paper. Like money are just, you know, coins. And obviously, if the bigger the pile of coins you have, the more money you have. Well, like in a similar way, that's the way the world was by and large understood. Not because people back in the Middle Ages, you know, had limited mental capacity like a 2-year-old, but simply because that's the way they saw things. In order to call an individual or a person righteous, they had to be really and truly intrinsically righteous. And so, when Martin Luther is reading Romans 1:17, and he says that in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. Well, that righteousness of God is formal and active, saying that in order for you to be saved, and the promise of the gospel is that you have to, in your person, become righteous as God is righteous. You need to have an active righteousness. So just as God is perfect and holy and everything he does is good and true and right, so you too have to imitate God actively to be righteous in the same way that God performs everything good and upright. So you too, in order to be saved and to have any hope in the gospel, must become righteous as God is righteous. You need to participate in your righteousness and achieve it actively by the exercise of your will. Now it says there in verse 17, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. And the righteous shall live by faith. And we hear that and we say, oh, what a relief. But would a medieval person, someone who's Roman Catholic, find relief in the requirement of faith and the notion of having faith? Is faith conceived of the same way in the medieval system? Well, obviously, to ask the question means by implication that no. Faith is fundamentally different in some very significant ways, which don't make this good news here easier. It actually makes it harder. Because when you're talking about faith in the medieval system, faith is a disposition for medievals. Faith is it's a habit of the mind, and it requires you to exercise So faith requires an exercise of the intellect and of the will. You have to know when you go back, anytime you go back and you read older literature from Christians before the 19th century, you have to know that they talk about the way that people make decisions in a lot of more complex ways than we do. They distinguish, an exercise of the mind, an intellect, means, so to have faith means you have to agree mentally, so you have to assent to the truths about God. That sounds pretty good. You need to agree mentally. You have to come to the conclusions. But then you also have to exercise to have true faith, not just an agreement mentally, but an exercise of your will. So you have to actually do things to have that faith formed. So you have to have your faith formed by exercising the mind and the will by acts of love or charity. I know this is a bit confusing. I'm going to try to clarify it. But to have true faith, to have faith in that medieval system, or as Martin Luther would understand it before he became a Protestant, would be that, you have to assent to the truth, you have to agree with it, but then you also have to have that faith formed and shaped and have it grow by actions of love and or charity. In other words, you have to obey. You have to grow. You need to have that faith shaped and transformed as you perform acts of the law, loving God and loving your neighbor. So if you look back at verse 17, if it says that righteousness or that the righteous shall live by faith, the way that he would understand that is to just say those that are inherently righteous, those that have righteousness in themselves, are righteous because they agree intellectually and they exercise their will to do a whole bunch of good deeds. And that's the hope of the gospel. So you can understand for him. That makes sense yet? Any questions so far? Any questions so far? Yes. Medieval and Roman Catholic view of faith. Those who have an active righteousness live according to intellectual assent and the exercise of obedience. And so the righteous, those who are inherently righteous, live by a whole lot of good works and good deeds. And that is how, essentially, you get saved. And for Martin Luther, as we read, that notion of salvation was crushing and was unbearable. Like he can say, then, why does God heap sorrow upon sorrow through the gospel, and through the gospel threaten us with his justice and his wrath? If you conceive of salvation this way, it's equivalent to God, he says, heaping sorrow through the gospel. And he can't escape this notion of requiring an active righteousness. Right? He can't. Righteousness of God can only be conceived of in terms of being inherently, intrinsically righteous. And that's where he and the entire church, really, in the West, was up until that point. And so he continues his story then in this little autobiographical piece. He then moves on and says, I meditated day and night on those words until at last, by the mercy of God, I paid attention to their context. The justice of God is revealed in it, as it is written. The just person lives by faith. And I began to understand that in this verse, the justice of God is that by which the just person lives by a gift of God, that is, by faith. And I began to understand that this verse means that the justice of God is revealed through the gospel, but it is a passive justice. It is a passive justice, i.e. that by which the merciful God justifies us by faith, as it is written, that the just person lives by faith. Okay, so what changes? Well, let me erase some of this. Now, whereas before he could only conceive of righteousness as something that's active in the person, now he says he realizes, or he began to realize, that now the justification, that's an A, there you go, being spoken of here is passive. It's passive. What do you think he might mean by justification now not being something active, but passive? What do you think he, just take a guess because we're good Protestants, what might he mean by justification being passive? Something that you receive, yes. What else? All those good words about justification, right? That it's, what's that? It's imputed, right? It's credited to you. Received by faith, the imputed righteousness of Christ. All these things start to make more sense simply by the shift in understanding righteousness or being justified from something active that you do to something passive that you simply receive, and something that is that lies outside of you. He says in another place, I think this is the Galatians commentary or the Romans commentary. He says, "This most excellent righteousness, the righteousness of faith, God imputes to us through Christ without works. It is purely and merely passive. For we work nothing, render nothing to God. We only receive and permit someone to work in us, namely God." So it's not, it's no longer a righteousness that's inherent, intrinsic to the individual. It's an alien righteousness, right? It lies outside of you as an individual. And it is the result of being declared righteous, not being made righteous. Now, a lot of things, obviously, at this time were happening, around the time to make this sort of interpretation possible, right? It had to be possible for people in that time to conceive, like to break that relationship between active righteousness, something that has to be inherent in order to be able to be called righteous. There was a lot going on. So, like Monica, right? Like my youngest daughter, who is just utterly incapable of conceiving of money in this abstract way or assigning value to something, like to saying that this, $5 bill is worth more than this pile of pennies. In a similar way, like people's way of thinking had to shift. And believe it or not, around that time, around the time of the Renaissance in the 1600s, times were changing. There were things happening. The conditions for belief were changing in a way to make this whole sort of thing possible. But up until this point, really, it would have been nearly impossible for anyone to conceive of being called righteous, even though you don't have an inherent righteousness, simply because it was not possible for people to believe that way. I mean, imagine of the things that people are able to believe now, which they would have been utterly incapable of thinking about in the past. I mean, there's simple things. I mean, you have all made a choice to attend Providence Church, right? You all choose to come to this church. If you lived, even around this time, you weren't choosing between the community church down the, down the street, the Pentecostal church up the road, the two or three, PNR churches in the area. There weren't multiple churches, and there was only one true church. Or just think of even things which seem more wild. I mean, to think, Greg, if I were to, and this is hopefully, it's getting recorded, so I'll be careful with my words. Greg, if 50 years ago, a young person came up to you who was clearly biologically male and told you that he was a woman, how would you respond to such a... I mean, not only would you be able to, would you disagree? Would you have some fundamental objections to that way of thinking like we do now? But it would be so completely irrational and incomprehensible to even, to even think that way. And you would only go to in that kind of moment an immediate diagnosis of like a mental health concern, or you'd be concerned for your own safety. And you still have the issue, but something has fundamentally changed to make certain things plausible for people where it wasn't in the past. And even though you may disagree and you may still find it problematic and have all these kind of objections, the mere fact that it is possible for people to conceive of the world and themselves that way means that things have changed, right? The conditions to believe certain things about reality have changed. And even though we object and we say, no, it's still nonsense, it does make enough sense for other people for them to legislate and do all kinds of sorts of things in order to defend that understanding. Yes. That's going to end the, that's going to, at the last part of this quote, we'll get to that, yeah, because he does say that he has to go back in order, like, to Augustine to see this similar thing. But you have a gap of, over 1,000 years between Augustine and Luther, where this kind of understanding about the righteousness of God wasn't conceivable. And that's the point. Like, we can look at the Bible and we can read these passages about justification, and it makes perfect clear sense to us because we have the ability to, to conceive of justification as a foreign or as an alien righteousness that is applied to us. But they had no way of being able to even think that way. And so that's what makes his discovery of, quote unquote, of justification by faith alone so radical, and which will just upend the Middle Ages and will cause a whole bunch of problems for him, as we'll see in the weeks to come in relation to the church. Medieval faith, just to go back a little bit, so his big insight here, his big work into Romans 1. Yes, it does cover some linguistic. There's some things we're going to get into in just a second here. We'll move a little bit quicker in these last 15 minutes or so. Yes, there is some work he does in Latin and the Greek, which we'll touch on. But fundamentally, the shift that he was making only really happened because the conditions for someone to believe this in the world weren't. It didn't come about until that particular point in time. So if you like read a bunch of stuff on Luther, or you talk to other historians, they will tell you that like most likely a reformation of some sort would have been possible just because of the way people were beginning to rethink the way the world worked. But it was Luther placing this emphasis on justification which really gave the Reformation its shape and its character. But to go back to Romans, right? Let's look back at Romans. I want to actually look at the real argument that he's making, and we'll talk about the particulars in this passage. If you turn over to not just Romans 1, but turn over to chapter 3. Turn over to chapter 3. I'm going to read this section on justification again, righteousness and justification. It says in verse 21, "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe, for there is no distinction. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of the God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus." And then down in verse 26, "It was to show his righteousness at the present time so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus." So in verse 24, when it talks about all have sinned, fall short of the glory of God, and are justified by his grace as a gift, we have to talk about this Latin. All right, anyone know Latin well? No? Not well? All right. So, the term, in the Western Church, you have to understand at this time that they, by and large, were just reading the Bible in what language? Latin. That was the language of choice. And then by the Renaissance, that's when you start to see more and more people get access to good Greek texts, more and more Greek scholarship being done, and where they can reevaluate how Latin was translated. Now, this term for to be justified in verse 24, justificare, I'm missing a C. I knew it looked weird. Justificare really just means to make righteous. Right? To make righteous. That's what that word translated means. And when you think about the medieval system that we were talking about, well, yeah, you have to be made righteous. You have to be made intrinsically, inherently righteous, right? So, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of the God and are, verse 24, made righteous by his grace as a gift. And this is the standard understanding in Latin. But if you reference the Greek and look at the original language of which the New Testament was written, is the Greek word for justified, which is this. Dikaiao. There you go. Thank you. Yeah. Does this mean, my seminary colleagues, does this mean to make righteous? Is that the best way to understand that word? Probably not. What's the more technically accurate way to describe this? To declare righteous. And so, reading verse 23 again, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are declared righteous by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus." Well, that means something different, doesn't it? That means something pretty radically different, if you ask me. And so the combination of, yeah, having access to more Greek resources, and also to make, you know, the conditions to interpret things a little bit differently, results in adjusting what had been, you know, centuries of mistranslation and error by just reexamining what being justified actually means. Martin Luther then realizes that instead of, if it is truly to be declared righteous, he realizes that instead of encouraging good works of the law to make someone righteous, the gospel offers that God would declare you righteous or consider you righteous and then eventually impute the alien righteousness to you as a gift, as it says there in verse 24. It's a gift that was accomplished through the redemption of Jesus Christ. Now, quickly, we only have a few minutes here. If the nature of justification changes, then also something has to be done to, just come over here. then we also have to fundamentally understand the nature of faith differently as well. Right? Whereas faith before would have required, in the medieval, assent, which is, we would say that that's still good, but then also would require the action of the will. So faith has to be formed by your good law-keeping action, acts of charity. Well, that has to change as well. And so for the reform, so for Luther, and then all of the reform that follow him, faith takes on a different character and a different quality just altogether. We still say that faith does require assent, right? It just means like agreement. But faith no longer principally has to do with actions of the will, but now we also add knowledge there. So we say, just so you have to know something, knowledge, assent, and then for Luther and then others, the key component of faith no longer is an exercise of the will, but becomes a matter of trust. He says this in the Romans commentary. Faith is a living, daring confidence in God's grace, so sure and certain that the believer would stake his life on it 1,000 times over. This knowledge of and confidence in God's grace makes us glad and bold and happy in dealing with God and with all creatures. Right? So faith no longer then has the character of you exercising your will, you doing things, of being informed by your actions, but principally just comes down to a matter of trust and dependence, confidence in what God has declared is for you, which is his very righteousness. So going back to that to that introduction, to the, you know, the little autobiographical piece we've been reading, he says that after he makes these changes, like these shifts, sees justification as passive, sees that God declares you righteous and doesn't make you righteous, and sees that faith is fundamentally about your assent and then trust, confidence and dependence on him, and not about the actions of the will, then salvation and the entire Bible, he'll say, is opened up to him. He says this. He said, all at once, I felt that I had been born again and entered into paradise itself through open gates. Immediately, I saw the whole of Scripture in a different life, or a different light. I ran through the Scriptures from memory and found that other terms had analogous meaning. For example, the work of God, that is what God works in us. The power of God, by which he makes us powerful. The wisdom of God, by which he makes us wise. The strength of God, the salvation of God, the glory of God. I exalted this sweetest word of mine, the justice of God, with as much love as before as I had hated it with hate. This phrase of Paul was for me the very gate of paradise. Afterward, I read Augustine's On the Spirit and the Letter, in which I found what I had dared not hope for. I discovered that he too interpreted the justice of God in a similar way, namely as that with which God clothes us when he justifies us. And although Augustine had said it imperfectly and did not explain in detail how God imputes justice to us, still it pleased me that he taught the justice of God by which we are justified. So, most certainly, he's not inventing something new. He's not, innovative. He's simply one who rediscovers what, through erroneous translation and a bad set of assumptions in the church, had led the church astray for centuries. Now, obviously, after this shift, it would necessitate a whole bunch of other changes to his theology and doctrine. And it's after this period, this early period, through like 1520 or so, that then all of the other, Roman conceptions about his theology will then start to just move away. And it's after this shift, obviously, because they were aware of this, of what this would mean. The next thing we're going to look at next week is the trouble that Martin Luther gets in with the church because of his ideas.